Welcome to Greatness, where the world's leading thinkers share their ideas about how to create greatness, great leaders, great teams, and great organizations. Why be good when you can be great? This is Gretchen Gagel, and I am so excited to welcome Professor Paula Gerber of the Monash Law Faculty to the Greatness Podcast. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. And I saw Paula on a NAWIC panel and later found out that Paula actually founded NAWIC, which we pronounce NAWIC in the United States. I always have to explain, my listeners are all over the globe, that it's pronounced differently over here. And I was just so fascinated by the different topics you were covering and your background that I thought I really, really need to have this person on the podcast. So you have two really distinct areas of focus around international human rights law and construction law. And I love hearing a little bit in the beginning of these podcasts about how did your life journey take you to those two areas of expertise?
Well, I always knew I wanted to be a lawyer. My father was a lawyer. My grandfather was a lawyer. So my brother's a lawyer. It's really in my blood. I knew I didn't want to do tax law because that was the area my father specialized in, and I found that incredibly boring. And I really just fell into construction law. And as they say, when you get dirt under your fingernails, you can't get it out. You're there. And so once I had the opportunity to specialise in construction law, I absolutely loved it, and I practiced as a construction lawyer for I think about 20 years. And then I just got sick of private practice. I got sick of recording my time in 6-minute units, and I really wanted to do something else. I say it was an early midlife crisis because I was only in my early 30s when this happened, or maybe mid 30s. And I was talking to a friend who said, "You still love the law, you're just sick of practicing construction law. Why don't you find a different aspect of the law that you enjoy?" So I thought, there's something to that. And I enrolled in a master's, and the very first subject I did was international human rights law. I said, this matters. This is what I want to do. And so I went on to do a PhD in children's rights and become a human rights law academic. But at the same time, I still had all this experience and this wealth of knowledge and a passion for construction law. So I didn't want to walk away from it. So I set up the Masters in Construction Law in the Melbourne University and became a construction law academic at the same time as I became a human rights law academic.
Wow. What a fascinating story. And so I was reading and doing a little research on you, Paula, and we had a near miss of working on the same things at the same time. I noticed that you were in California from 90 to 94, I believe it was, working on disputes avoidance processes in the construction industry. And I was actually hired in 1994 by a company called FMI to do partnering processes on construction projects, where I was sent in to 2 or 3 projects a week, and on top of doing strategy work for engineering and construction firms, but spent a lot of time trying to keep construction projects out of litigation.
Yeah, look, it's interesting because America and California in particular has this reputation of being highly litigious. Yet that's where I learned about dispute avoidance processes, and that's where I really became passionate and accredited as a mediator. And so whilst there are a lot of disputes, they are also, I think, at the forefront of trying to avoid disputes and manage disputes so that they don't escalate into litigation or arbitration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a fascinating way, even though I'd been running manufacturing plants out of engineering school and joined this firm in 94 and kind of had grown up in construction. My dad was in a construction equipment dealer, so I guess it was kind of in my blood too. So founding NAWIC, 1995. So you come back to Australia, you're immersed in the construction industry. What prompts you to start NAWIC in Australia?
Yeah, so I had been a member of NAWIC in Los Angeles in the Santa Monica chapter, and I absolutely loved it because the firm that I worked with in California was a boutique construction law firm, and every lawyer in the practice was male. And so I was craving a connection with a more diverse part of the construction industry, construction practice. And so I stumbled upon NAWIC, and that's where I found sort of my people. And I really enjoyed getting to know all these amazing, dynamic, strong, successful women. And so I came back to Australia after 10 years away. I really didn't have many, I didn't have a network here. And so I thought, well, NAWIC is a place where I met people in California. I'll join it here. And it didn't exist. So I started, as my secretary said, calling every woman who ever picked up a hammer, and I found just incredible enthusiasm for having an organization for women in construction. So I think if I'd known how big it was going to get and how much time it was going to take, I probably wouldn't have embarked on it. But ignorance can be bliss. And yeah, I just started on this journey, and it took off like wildfire, including in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I feel like I kind of just had my head down in the beginning of my career, just trying to figure out, similar to you, without a lot of other female attorneys in your law firm, the big investment banking strategy firm I joined in 94. I think we had 170 consultants and two of us were female. And so, and I started having kids. I had a child in 96 and a child in 97, and, you know, flying 100,000 miles and having a baby in the same year. And then I took a bit of a left turn and left the industry and ran a women's foundation for 5 years. And that's where I really developed the strong women's network. So when I came back into the construction industry in 2013, really bringing that passion and understanding for what a great industry it is for women and how we create more opportunity for women. So what have been some of your highlights since 1995, different things that NAWIC has accomplished over here in Australia?
There've been many, and there's also been many disappointments, if you like. So I think what was very satisfying in the early days was the support for NAWIC. All the big construction companies got on board. They were signing up all their female staff as members. They were sponsoring the organisation. The federal government was similarly almost throwing money at us to seed funding to get the organisation off the ground, and also funding to produce what back then was a video on careers for women in construction. Because one of the things that I recognised was no one was encouraging young girls to come into this industry. Their parents weren't saying, you'd be a great plumber. Their careers counsellor wasn't saying, you'd be a great engineer. And they didn't often even know what those sort of careers involved and that there was a place for them in the industry. So producing that video that was then sent to every secondary school across Australia was one of the highlights. Just bringing women together and which I think was very much had a role to play in reducing the attrition rate of women in the construction industry, because certainly if you feel like you're constantly the only woman on the project or in the industry or in the sector, then you can often get disheartened and leave. So NAWIC created this space where women felt they weren't alone. They didn't have to take on all these battles for gender equality, you know, on their own. The disappointments are that 25 years later, we're still having the same conversations and we're still seeing the same very low rates of participation by women in the construction industry. So I think we've still got a long way to go, and that saddens me. I thought we'd be further ahead now when I set up NAWIC in 95.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I was gone for 8 years and I came back and I'm like, wow, okay, no progress. And I was sitting in Orlando earlier this year at the Construction Industry Institute Construction User Roundtable Conference. Probably less than 10% of the crowd was female. I'm presenting a study there in February. And so I actually tape recorded a message for the members to encourage them to think about the diversity of their contingency to the conference. But it is interesting. You and I were talking right before we started recording about, I also met Andre Noonan during the NAWIC conference and did a podcast with him about a construction project here, a girls' school that achieved 53% of women on the job site. And he said, and it's recorded on the podcast, he thinks 5 years from now, we won't be having these conversations anymore. I told him I'll be drinking champagne with you if 5 years from now, gender diversity is not an issue in the construction industry.
I certainly do not share his optimism because we've got this really difficult obstacle that we've got to overcome. Women don't want to come into an industry that has such a poor culture, that is so adversarial, that is so machismo, where they don't feel welcome. And yet until we get more women into the industry, the culture is not going to change. So it's this real chicken and egg about how we get gender equality in the construction industry.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, that's the other point of connection for you and I, serving on the Construction Industry Culture Task Force here in Australia. And there's a similar effort going on in the United States, the AGC's Culture of Care, to really recognize that we need to change the culture. So, Paula, what do we do? We have lots of listeners out there in the construction industry. What steps are in our future? What do we need to do to achieve gender diversity, do you think, in the construction industry?
Well, I think it's probably not a very popular viewpoint, but I think it's time for us to look seriously at quotas, because we've been having conversations about increasing the number of women in the construction industry for decades, and we're getting, I think, nowhere if not going backwards. So I think that we need to look at other models, which include saying, on any government project, for example, X percentage of the businesses must be women-owned businesses, or X percentage of the workers at a particular level must be women. So what we don't want is, the lollipop traffic controllers to be women. That doesn't change anything. We need women in positions of leadership. And everyone says, but if you force people, it doesn't actually bring about the cultural change. I would disagree with that. I think that initially there's resistance and people might try and find ways of getting around these rules. That always happens when you introduce new laws. But I think it doesn't take that long for people to go, okay, this is the way it is, and to then start recognizing the benefits that flow from having a more diverse workforce.
Yeah, I would agree with you that that may be a popular thought process within some people to think about quotients, but I'm sitting here thinking, Paula, it also ties into this bigger image challenge we have in the construction industry. So when I came back into the construction industry, I'd been in this very visible, high profile position in Denver, Colorado. And so most people didn't even know I'd ever worked in construction running this women's foundation. And my girlfriends were like, wow, you work in construction. And I look at them and I say, look, if you want to drive on a road, if you want to plug your cell phone in and charge it, if you want to have a baby in a hospital or sit in a movie theater or a restaurant, it all gets constructed. Like, we build and maintain the assets of society. And yet that connection, people think, well, I'm going to go be a doctor because I'm going to save lives. Well, we keep the buildings from collapsing. we're doing this huge service to society. And I don't think that message really gets out effectively.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. And that's what I say to my students. It's I'm talking here about my law students. When I'm teaching construction law as an elective that they can do, I talk about, well, why did I get into this career? I said, it's really tangible. I can look around and say, I was involved in the building of that bridge or that hospital, or, I did the contracts for this student accommodation. I said, I did a couple of years in banking and finance, and all I did was shuffle papers, and it didn't seem tangible. It didn't seem real. Whereas, construction, pardon the pun, is very concrete. And so it's a very rewarding area to be working in.
Yeah, it is. I made my kids nuts one year. We were doing a light rail highway project in Denver, and I rarely worked on projects in Denver, but this one happened to be near our neighborhood, so we drove through it quite a bit. And I think there were about 10 or 11, 11 and 12 at the time, and I was always talking about something. Oh, they're about to blow this bridge. They're going to have X number of months to put the new one in, or something related to construction. They're like, oh, Mom, you know, stop talking about the construction project. But it is, it's very tangible. So I'm a man out there listening in the construction industry. What can I do to support the advancement of women in our industry as a male?
You can actively recruit women into the industry so that you are taking positive steps to address the low numbers of women in the industry. And women need mentors, so you can most definitely be a mentor. It's a furphy to think that a woman's mentor should be a woman. It should be someone who can help them in their career progression. You should be very understanding of the different pressures that women face, women employees face, in terms of, you know, maternity leave and carers leave. We still tend to be the ones who have the majority of care responsibilities within the family situation, whether that's caring for young children or elderly parents, or sometimes, as I had, both at the same time. Recognise that numbers are important. It's to overcome this feeling of isolation. You don't want to be the token woman on the construction site. And the research out of Norway suggests that when you get 40% women participation, that's when you see a change in the culture and an acceptance of women having a valuable role to play in construction. So a man listening to this shouldn't be thinking about, oh, I can hire a woman for this role or that role. It's like, how can I actually get 40% of my workforce being female? And little things like making sure that it is a safe and welcoming space for women. I mean, I've been on construction sites where it was assumed that I was the stripper, because what other woman would be coming to a construction site? I've been on construction sites where you walk into the sheds and there's pictures of topless women, you know, on the walls, where there haven't been suitable toilet facilities for women. So even basic things like that, that make women feel valued and appreciated and respected. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, because when I speak with both men and women, what's good for women is good for everybody, because it is about, it's about respect. It's about valuing people and diverse ideas that they bring. So Paula, what's on the horizon for you? What are the fun things that you're working on, researching, et cetera?
I'm working on a second edition of a book that I published in 2013, I think, about dispute avoidance. So there's lots of books written out there about arbitration and litigation and how to resolve disputes. There's not in my mind enough out there about how to avoid disputes. So I'm updating that. I'll be looking, you know, including chapters on BIM, on AI, in terms of assisting us with managing construction conflicts, and really recognising that conflicts are inevitable, but they don't have to be negative. They can be positive, because they can result in actually coming up with solutions about how to do things better. I'm then working on another construction law book that is sort of looking at the front end of things. So how do we, what sort of contractual project delivery mechanisms do we use that actually make it more likely that it will be an adversarial culture on the project? So you were talking earlier about partnering, and that's gone out of favour a bit now, but really the principles of partnering should still inform and underpin the way we do contractual arrangements on construction projects. So writing a book that really is hoping to contribute to a conversation about radically rethinking how we engage in contractual arrangements with each other, and to really promote more of a collaborative, cooperative relationship between all the parties. And this idea that you know, it's not a win-lose situation. What's, you know, a win for me doesn't have to be a loss for you, that there are ways, and it's not some just utopic fantasy, there are ways where we can have a win-win outcome for everyone. I have discovered in my career that sometimes my views are not really valued by construction lawyers, because there are a lot of lawyers out there who make a lot of money from construction disputes. And so I often find resistance to this idea of more collaboration and cooperation, because they don't want to give up the steady stream of income that they get from construction disputes. And it is embarrassing how much money is wasted every year on construction disputes. So really, my passion is the same now as it was when I returned to Australia in 1995. I want to see more women in the construction industry, not just because that's the right thing to do, but because it's good for business. Because more women in construction will mean less disputes, and that's better for the construction industry and the economy and the country as a whole.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's so great. You know, I don't hear as much about IPD contracts, integrated project delivery contracts, here in Australia. That's something that Howard Ashcroft and other people in the United States have really been promoting. But you and I are very aligned in that. I actually shifted in the late 90s over to consulting for the large corporations and government agencies that buy engineering and construction services, to try and convince them that low initial price doesn't equal low total delivered cost, and that we need to think about deeply about our contractual relationships and where does the risk sit, and are we paying the person or the organization or entity that's most capable of managing the risk to manage the risk, right? Are we trying to just shift the risk onto other people but not compensate them for it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think where there is a real opportunity for change is by talking to government, by talking to the purchaser of construction services, because if they keep using contracts which put all the risk on a contractor and consultants, regardless of who can best manage that risk, nothing is going to change. And, you know, change is what we so desperately need. And yet it's also the thing that people are so frightened of. Even if they're not happy about the way risk is allocated in a contract, the way projects are managed, there's still some comfort in, well, this is the way we've always done it. I mean, one of the things that blows my mind is that the standard form contract, AS4000, which is, you know, the one published by Standards Australia, it was published in 1997. It is nearly 25 years old and it hasn't been updated. And we tried. We came out with AS11000 as a new standard form contract to replace AS4000, and it had dispute avoidance processes in there and it had good faith obligations in there, and it died. The industry, consultants, they couldn't agree. We couldn't get consensus that this is a good model of contract. So everyone's still using AS4000 from 1997.
Well, the industry needs people like yourself that advocate. I just returned from the United States, where I was inducted into the National Academy of Construction in the U.S.
Congratulations.
Thank you. In recognition of the same thing, trying to roll my sleeves up and affect systemic change. The industry is so fortunate to have you. So as we wrap up here, I'm a woman in construction. Maybe I'm feeling a little lonely. Maybe I'm feeling a little disrespected. Maybe I'm just not sure this is the industry for me. What's your advice to women that are looking to make their mark on the construction industry?
My advice would be, if you can, without damaging your own health and well-being, if you can stick it out through the good times and the bad, it's worth it. It's a very rewarding and satisfying career. And I would encourage you to become involved in the organisations that are available to support you, like NAWIC, like Women in Trades, and to find that support network, because it is out there and you don't have to do this alone and you don't have to feel isolated. And talk to people. There's, whether they're men or women, is talk to people about the struggles that you might be experiencing and ask for help. It can be really hard because we still portray asking for help as a sign of weakness, whereas I think it's a sign of strength. Strength of character that, you know, I'm reaching my limit, I need some help here, and I'm going to put my hand up and ask for it. And, yeah, I'd just say stick it out if you can, because it really is a very satisfying career. And if you're not getting that level of satisfaction from the role that you're in, then the word that we've become very comfortable with during COVID is pivot. Find another role. I mean, I got sick of private practice, and I moved into academia. I'm still in construction law. I'm just doing it in a different way. So look at whether there is some other way that you can be in the construction industry that might be a better fit for you.
Yeah. Paula, that's such great advice. I really, really appreciate you carving time out of your incredibly busy schedule to visit the Greatness Podcast. Thanks so much. And we'll look forward to seeing those books.
Thank you very much. I really welcome the opportunity of chatting with you.
Interested in hearing more? Visit us at greatnessconsulting.com. Thank you.